Hi. My name is Michael McQuarrie. I'm an associate professor of sociology here at LSE, and I am delighted to host you all tonight. I want to welcome you to this LSE Cities event, where we'll be where Thomas Sugru, who's a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University, will be speaking to us about the Detroit bankruptcy. Just a couple of things before we get started. Tom will be talking for about 50 minutes to an hour, and then we'll be having Q&A. The event will be recorded, and hopefully it will be put up as a hopefully the video will be available on the LSE or the events webpage after the event. The hashtag for tonight's event is LSE Detroit, and let's see. Please put your mobile phones on silent before we get started, although certainly you should use it for anything else that you might need to do during the course of the event. And let me tell you a little about Tom. Tom is an urban historian, probably the foremost urban historian working in the United States today. He's a historian of race, cities, suburbs, civil rights, and politics. He's the author of numerous books and articles. Among them are his first book, which was published in 1996, which is The Origins of the Urban Crisis. This is a classic of urban history and has been deemed by Princeton University Press to be one of the 100 most influential books the press has published in the last 100 years. The book, which centers on the deindustrialization and depopulation of Detroit, has recently been updated in a 2014 edition to cover the Detroit bankruptcy. On a personal note, this is also a book that warranted a switch in my own academic career from being a British social historian to being an American urban sociologist. Tom is also the author of Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North, which is the definitive history of that movement in the northern United States. Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race, which is an analysis of Obama's presidency and its meaning for race in America. I could go on and on listing a number of other books and articles, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to ask you to please join me in welcoming Thomas Sugru tonight to the LSE.
Thank you very much, Michael, for the kind words and introduction. It's great to be here. I spent a lot of time in London in the mid-1980s, a very different moment, as you all know, in the history of the city, and I've basically not been back since. So as an urbanist here for 3 weeks, I've been spending a lot of time poking around the sorts of places that I once poked around and finding it's changed, maybe as much as Detroit, the city I'll be talking about tonight, has changed since the 1980s. I am going to set this up. So what I'm going to do this evening is give you an overview of the trajectory of Detroit in the years leading up to its extraordinary bankruptcy, which happened in 2013, and looking at the larger implications of Detroit's bankruptcy for the reimagination of this quintessential post-industrial city. I am not, for those of you interested in urban finance, going to go into great detail about the actual process of the bankruptcy and its settlement itself, although I'm happy to talk about it at length. That's really an entire talk in its own right, and it's the subject of a project that I'm working on at the moment with a documentary filmmaker, so I can talk about it at great length should you be interested in the details of municipal finance, of pensions, and of the extraordinary so-called grand bargain, bringing together more than $150 million in foundation money to simultaneously save the Detroit Institute of Arts, one of the great art museums in the United States, and the pension fund that paid city employees, firefighters, and police officers at about 93% of its value. So that's a long and interesting story. But let me begin with the moment of bankruptcy in Detroit, and that was on July 17th, 2013, when the city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy in federal court. It was the largest municipality in American history to do so, although it had been foreshadowed by bankruptcies in places as diverse as Stockton and Vallejo, California, Jefferson County, Alabama, and Central Falls, Rhode Island, all much smaller places than Detroit. And in many ways, it's a precursor to the current crisis that the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is facing. Right now in the midst of what could very well be the first Commonwealth-wide bankruptcy. And it could possibly be the foreshadowing of bankruptcies in other major municipalities. Perhaps one at the greatest risk of bankruptcy right now is Chicago, the third largest city in the United States, which has an extraordinary financial crisis beneath the veneer of the city's neoliberal leadership under Rahm Emanuel. But I won't be talking about Chicago. The bankruptcy comes in an immediate context of what happened to Detroit between 2000 and 2010. In the last decade, American censuses are collected every 10 years. Between 2000 and 2010, Detroit lost 25% of its already significantly fallen population to about 700,000 people. To give you a sense of the contrast, at peak in 1950, Detroit had 1.5 million people. In fact, some suggest that in the early 1950s, when the city was at its economic zenith, it had probably about 2 million residents. Today, its population is down to somewhere in the ballpark of 660 or 670,000. Many experts, demographers, suggest that Detroit will probably eventually bottom out somewhere around a half a million people by the 2020 or maybe the 2030 census. If you take a look at the next slide here, you can see that virtually no section of the city of Detroit did not lose population and quite substantial population between 2000 and 2010. The areas in the red are blocks in the city, census blocks in the city that saw population loss. The darker the red, the greater the population loss. Some lost as much as 100% of their population. The areas in blue are areas that saw a population gain, and we'll talk a little bit about those areas in a little while. One of the consequences of the devastation of Detroit is that the city is plagued with empty land and abandoned properties. Depending on how you measure vacancy, somewhere between 21 and 40 square miles of the city of Detroit, which is 139 square miles, is now vacant. So a vast section of the city is vacant. And here you can see vacancy rates disproportionately concentrated. Disproportionately concentrated on the city's east side, but also parts of the lower west side, areas where essentially you have densities that are rural, that is, places that have seen a near complete abandonment of the land. This is part of the city's east side. I will point this out to give you a slide. East Kirby Street is right about right in here, and you can see that essentially, this could be an aerial view of farmland, minus the fact that Detroit still has an infrastructure designed for a city with a population of 2 million people, including fairly wide streets, a complete sewer and water system, an electrical system, etc., all constructed when the city was rapidly growing in the first half of the 20th century. This is a photograph taken by an urban geographer at the Sorbonne who's doing very interesting research on Detroit, showing the landscape in the summer on the city's east side. You can see this does not look, by even the most generous definition, like an urban place, other than the fact that you have streets and sidewalks and stop signs. At the peak of the summer, this grass will get so tall that it'll be 5 or 6 feet tall. Nature has reclaimed large parts of the city, and one can find now flocks of pheasants that have taken over parts of the city. Raccoons, deer, coyotes have moved back in to a place that's essentially been reclaimed by nature. By best estimate in Detroit, about 90,000 homes have been abandoned, many during the last 10 years as the city lost 25% of its population. There are about 90,000 abandoned houses. This is a fairly typical street of working class houses. These were built mostly in the 1920s. These are houses that were built mostly in the 1920s as well. It does not take long for a typical Detroit wood frame house to go from full occupancy to deterioration. They're mostly made of wood. Vandals come and strip most of the metal from these properties. In fact, scrap metal sales has been one of the growth industries in Detroit. A house goes abandoned for a very short period of time, and folks come in and strip away all the copper from the inside, all of the plumbing fixtures, etc., and sell them to scrap metal dealers, particularly when scrap metal prices are high. Indeed, when I was in Detroit with a film crew from BBC Scotland about 8 or 9 years ago, there were two repair crews out on the streets of Detroit's east side. One was replacing the lids to sewer openings. They're about 3 or 4 inches thick. They're made out of iron. They're super heavy. And folks were coming and stealing them because iron prices were very high at that moment. Even more stunningly, they were also electrical crews out replacing the overhead wires. They're rubber wires with copper on the inside. And at night, scavengers come, pull down the wires, every once in a while getting electrocuted, take out knives, strip away the rubber, pull out the copper, and then sell it to scrap dealers. When I was there just 2 summers ago, during a baseball game in Detroit's downtown stadium, there was an airplane carrying a banner flying over saying, "Scrap metal?" And then it gave a phone number for you to call if you had scrap metal that you were willing to get rid of. Some of the grandest sections of Detroit, these are Victorian-era mansions built near the center of Detroit, have also completely reverted to nature. The buildings crumbling away, or in the case of the one on the left, desperately trying to be preserved by historic preservationists. Arson is a huge problem in Detroit. Many of these empty houses attract vandals. Even sections of the city with some vitality are often eerily deserted. This is another photograph that Dr. Pidou from the Sorbonne, the urban geographer, took. And this is the middle of the day. You can see it's late afternoon based on the shadows. Essentially, these large streets built for a functioning city of 2 million people are now completely abandoned. Detroit's housing crisis has also put some extreme burdens on the city, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. Perhaps the most significant being that the city of Detroit is now in possession of, I will have the data right here, as of this last fall, 51,000 properties that have fallen into tax delinquency, basically meaning that they're abandoned, and those who have title to the property have stopped paying their municipal taxes. Losing the property taxes from 51,000 properties is devastating to a city whose finances are already in dire straits. Well, while Detroit in the 2000s was dealing with the massive flight of population, it's also dealt for a long time with significant structural unemployment. I could give you a longer run of data than the data that I show here, but Detroit has seen a fluctuation of its unemployment rate between its peak of about 26% in 2009 to its low during the boom years of the late 1990s, still at about 6 to 7%. So this is a city that has suffered really significant chronic unemployment problems, which have further devastating consequences for every aspect of life in the city, including demands on the city government to provide services to its impoverished residents, as well as the lack of tax revenue because so many of the residents of the city do not have incomes sufficient to pay into the city's tax coffers. Detroit only has one fully functioning auto factory within its boundaries, despite the fact that the city has long been known as the Motor City. It's a place where there are still a significant amount of auto industry functions, primarily on the engineering and business side, that are located within the boundaries of the city of Detroit. But this is a city that had somewhere around 200,000 automobile manufacturing jobs in 1950, and as of the bankruptcy, had only about 8,000 auto industry jobs in total, the vast majority of them white-collar positions. The only silver lining in Detroit economically, well, that's not a silver lining. The only silver lining in Detroit, I thought I had a slide for it, but I buried it away elsewhere in the slideshow, is that like every major former industrial city in the United States between the 1950s and the 2000s, there was one significant growth sector in the economy. And that significant growth sector in the economy were jobs that in one way or another were related to the government, that relied significantly on government subsidies or direct government payment. That is public sector employment and what we in the United States call meds and eds, or medicine and higher education, both of which expanded significantly in places like Detroit in the period of deindustrialization. Detroit, at the brink of bankruptcy, had about 40 to 50,000 meds, eds, and public sector jobs. Those jobs made up the vast majority of employment opportunities for the city's small and struggling African-American middle-class population. And those jobs expanded in the period because of increased federal spending on healthcare beginning in the 1960s, because of the steadiness, at least for a time, of government employment at all levels, from federal to local, and because of the expansion of higher education in the 1960s. Those institutions, the federal government and local governments, hospitals and universities, are also sticky institutions. Unlike the auto industry and other industries that picked up and moved in search of low wages or less regulation, meds and eds and public employment stayed rooted in the city. So that, in some ways, is the one bright story about the city's economy. In other words, by the time of the bankruptcy, public sector education and medicine jobs dwarfed auto industry jobs in the Motor City. Detroit, in other words, had become the hospital and higher education and government city, not the Motor City. So what happens? What happened? To understand the bankruptcy, to understand the crisis that Detroit was facing in that period of sharp population decline between 2000 and 2010 requires for a moment putting on my historian's hat and going back in time. And debunking some of the most commonplace explanations for Detroit's fate. So in 2013, in the late summer, when Detroit declared bankruptcy, I decided that I would pick up the phone or answer emails for every media inquiry that came my way about Detroit, mostly because the conventional wisdom on Detroit and on many other major American cities, especially industrial cities, has solidified into a sort of encrusted conventional wisdom, a conventional wisdom that seems so obvious to so many Americans that it scarcely comes under challenge, even in the pages of places like the New York Times or The Economist. So the conventional wisdom about Detroit's problem, that you could say the prehistory to the Detroit bankruptcy, goes something like this. Detroit was an extraordinary and bustling city until the 1960s. The critical turning point, and this shows up in nearly every article on Detroit, was the uprising or riot of 1967, one of the worst in American history. 43 people died in a week of uprising on the streets of the city. Nearly 100 of 139 of the city's square miles were hit in one way or another by looting, by clashes between the police and predominantly African-American residents. More than 7,000 people were arrested. Eventually, one of the most elite units of the U.S. military, the 101st Airborne, was deployed to put down the uprising in Detroit. after 33 of the people of the 43 who died in the riot had been shot mostly by the local police or by inexperienced National Guardsmen, who most of whom had never spent any time in the city whatsoever. Many lay blame on this critical moment in the 1960s for the fate of Detroit. If only somehow we could roll the clock back. If only somehow we could return to the pre-1967 moment, Detroit would continue to be a vital, thriving city, or so the conventional wisdom goes. That conventional wisdom is reinforced by two other narratives. One focuses on the social policies and programs of the welfare state in the United States, focusing specifically on the politics of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president in the 1960s, who decided to declare war on poverty. On the right, and on large parts of the Democratic Party's center, now mainstream, it is axiomatic that Lyndon Johnson's welfare policies were devastating to cities, primarily because of their negative effects on African-American residents. And in, at the time of the uprising in Detroit, about 45% of the city's residents were African-American, depriving them of the incentive to work, and simultaneously subsidizing broken families, leading to the urban crisis that devastated so many of these cities in the 60s and beyond. Related to that is another commonplace explanation, and this is one that has particular salience for explanation of the Detroit bankruptcy. That is, the story of Detroit is a story of black power and black political mismanagement. In the aftermath of the Detroit uprising of 1967, Detroit became a majority African-American city. In 1973, it elected its first African-American mayor, Coleman Young, former labor organizer, turned politician, turned mainstream, indeed moderate, austerian Democrat in the 1970s. Coleman Young generates still in Detroit an incredible amount of debate. For many African Americans in the city, he was the embodiment of race pride. Indeed, he reached out to his black constituents arguing that he embodied their aspirations to political power. He wrapped himself in the rhetorical mantle of black power. To many whites, he was the mayor who was responsible for alienating what were perceived to be otherwise well-meaning white residents of Detroit who would have accepted racial equality had it not been for his polarizing rhetoric. When it comes to the city's finances, many blame Coleman Young's administration for financial profligacy, for fiscal profligacy, that is, for misspending the city's finances and further creating a crisis. And it's true that Detroit faced serious fiscal problems during his 20-year administration as mayor, but most of them were not his doing. Indeed, Coleman Young presided over a city that saw a dramatic decline in its tax base as a result of the ongoing effects of industrial flight, and he presided over a period when the city's property tax base began to decline as its African-American population continued to grow. But he was, to a great extent, a classic 1970s austerity Democrat in the mold of President Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s. He balanced the city's budget nearly every one of his 20 years in office. He significantly reduced the city's public employee workforce, even though many of them were African American and among his most staunch supporters. He began to close city playgrounds and parks as a way of trying to keep the city's finances in balance. And he struggled with a climate of financial difficulty exacerbated by the fact that state and federal governments, beginning in the 1970s, greatly intensifying in the 1980s, dramatically cut their subsidies for nearly every aspect of urban life, from infrastructure to social welfare to education. There was a profound drop over the course of the period from the 1970s onward in urban spending, most significantly during the era of Ronald Reagan, when federal expenditures for cities went from 12% of the federal budget to 3% of the federal budget, leaving places like Detroit having to fend for themselves financially. Well, Coleman Young's administration then, both because of the intense racial politics that surrounded him, but also because the city was facing significant external constraints on its finances during that period, often takes the blame. The commonplace explanation of Detroit's bankruptcy is it begins with this man. But the person who really takes the blame for Detroit's bankruptcy in the story of black mismanagement was one of his successors, one of the most interesting political figures to trot across the urban stage in the United States in the 2000s, and this was Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick is a very, very interesting figure. He's in jail at the moment, and he will be in jail for most of the next 20 or so years. He was convicted of 24 felonies, including bribery, extortion, racketeering, and rigging city contracts. And his downfall came when, unbeknownst to anyone, he was having an affair with his chief of staff, a young, attractive woman he had known since high school, used city police officers to cover up that affair, and then deleted all of the text messages and emails, some of them quite sordid, only to have investigators discover that his cell phone company still had records of all of those transcripts, leading to not only all sorts of a scandal in terms of the self-dealing and contracting and misuse of police power, but also sordid tabloid fare as they described various sexual proclivities that they shared, made available through the release of these during his trial. But Kwame Kilpatrick and his personal malfeasance was not responsible for the Detroit bankruptcy. In fact, most of the self-dealing and extortion that he was involved in was incredibly petty. It didn't involve large amounts of money, at least by the standards of the city's declining finances. Rather, Kwame Kilpatrick, when he became mayor, was hailed by the right of the Democratic Party, the centrist Democrats, the neoliberals, as we might call them, as a mayor who was going to be one of the great hopes for the future of the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. That is, he was the so-called hip-hop mayor, culturally relevant, on the cutting edge of popular culture trends, but simultaneously someone who was fiscally conservative. Closely tied to the financial sector in a period of ebullience in that financial sector. So his most lasting legacy was not his sordid affair or the petty dealing that he was engaged in. It was a decision that he and his administration, in collaboration with New York and Washington-based law firms, with some of the leading financial and insurance institutions in the United States, vetted by the nation's top accounting firms, entered into a deal in 2005 to restructure Detroit's municipal pension system. A restructuring that involved such well-known firms that were implicated in the financial crisis globally in 2008, UBS, Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Financial Guarantee, XL Capital Insurance, and on it goes. Some of the country's most important financial firms in the country. In 2005, the well-respected industry periodical, The Bond Buyer, hailed Detroit's $18 million pension deal as the deal of the year. It involved risky derivatives and credit default swaps, and lauded Kilpatrick and his administration for their leadership in working with Wall Street to come up with a creative way of dealing with the city's intensifying crisis, particularly involving its municipal pensions. This, of course, was what led to Detroit's immediate financial crisis in 2008, when the deal collapsed and Detroit was left holding the bag of having to deal with the fallout of the 2008 crisis. But To understand the Detroit bankruptcy, to understand what it's going on, requires us once again not just to focus on these immediate moments, but to step back, to understand why it is that the city got itself into a situation where it cut an extraordinarily complex, messy financial deal with some of the top firms in the United States to lead it to what would become its bankruptcy. And that means stepping back away from the financial mismanagement, or actually excellent management by the standards of the industry in 2005 of the Kilpatrick administration, and getting back to a longer view of the city's history. So I want to step back. This is a stepping even further back into history for a moment before we step forward back into the present. Detroit's woes, Detroit's financial troubles, the moment that led to the 2005 deal was one that was very, very, very long in coming. It was not the consequence of the Detroit riot of 1967. It was not the consequence of the politics of Coleman Young, and it was not at root structurally, the cause caused by the financial deals that the Kilpatrick administration engaged in, although that's a very important part of the story. Detroit's story is a story of decades of urban transformation in the United States, the consequence of the transformation of industry, the persistence of racial division in the United States, and federal policies, state policies, and local policies that systematically disadvantage cities. Detroit, of course, by the 1920s, was the world capital of the auto industry, giving its prominent, its most preeminent firm, giving its name to a term that all urban geographers, sociologists, economists, and historians use to describe this period of urban transformation, Fordism. Detroit was the capital of the auto industry and went from being a minor city in the United States to being, at its peak, the fourth largest city in the United States. This is Detroit around 1940, at its peak of power. Detroit made its fortune as the center of the American automobile industry, as the place where the assembly line was invented and where the auto industry attracted workers by deploying a new strategy of employment, paying workers decent wages. This is the epicenter of Detroit's auto industry, the place where, in many respects, it all began. Not quite. It didn't literally begin here. This plant was built in 1914. This is the Ford Highland Park plant. This plant is the most important plant in the industrial history of the 20th century. It is where Ford introduced assembly line technology to mass-produce cars, and it's where, in 1914, Ford introduced the $5 day, paying workers wages that were unprecedented in major industry. The center of Fordism was this extraordinary facility, the Ford River Rouge plant. River Rouge, taking its name from a river that on its best day was rouge and on its worst day was vert or marron. River Rouge, the River Rouge plant, was the capital of integrated production. This is an amazing place. It still exists. At its peak in about 1945, it employed 90,000 workers. Today, it employs about 2,400 workers. And this entire vast facility extending over about 4 square miles. This is the epitome of Fordism. This became a model for industrialization in the Soviet Union, in post-Second World War II Japan, in reconstructed Germany. Indeed, the lead architect of both the Highland Park and the Ford River Rouge plant, a man named Albert Kahn, was responsible for importing much of this design to large parts of the industrializing world in the first half of the 20th century. Fordism and Detroit really mattered. It had everything from shipping docks where raw materials were sent in, including coal and iron ore, because they had their own foundry. They made their own steel. They had their own stamping plant, which is they turned the steel into car parts. They made car glass. They manufactured every part of the car, and they made the car there. This proved to be a problematic model. In many respects, most notably, any one section of the Ford River Rouge plant goes on strike and the entire industry shuts down because when you're talking about one facility that's doing everything with 90,000 workers, they have a lot of clout over the process. Detroit was also the nation's arsenal of democracy, as it was called during the Second World War. It was a major center of defense production, something that turned the city into an even greater economic powerhouse until the post-Second World War II period, when both the auto and defense industries began to decentralize. Defense because of fears of concentrating production in a single site that could be attacked, especially by nuclear weapons. The auto industry dispersing increasingly to take advantage of new markets, but also to take advantage of lower wages, lower regulation, lower taxes, and lower costs in other parts of the United States, increasingly rural areas, and by the 1960s and 1970s, the South, where wages and regulation were significantly less than they were in the North. One of the grandest plans, and this is one that has become iconic, particularly in the genre of ruins porn, that is, photographs of Detroit's decay, was the massive Packard plant, also designed by the ubiquitous Albert Kahn. The Packard plant extended over 1 square mile. It's vast, and it reached its peak after the Second World War, but through a series of quirky company history that I won't tell you about, it went belly up and shut down its production in Detroit in 1957. The Packard plant now exists as a ghastly ruin. The place, other than Detroit's old train station, that every ruins pornographer going to Detroit must visit. Indeed, I visit there. I've gone there quite frequently. This is a picture that I'm taking. And you can see here that essentially this is a really well-built building, but scrappers have taken away most of the metal. There's another view of the plant, and there's another view. What Detroit began to experience in the post-Second World War II years was the flight of its auto industry away from the city. Between 1947 and 1963, Detroit lost about 140,000 manufacturing jobs, leading to the beginning of the process that would eventually lead to the Detroit bankruptcy. When you lose that many jobs and lose many of the property tax and income tax generating employers in the city, you begin to see the groundwork being laid for the Detroit bankruptcy. Indeed, by the early 1960s, after the city had lost 140,000 jobs, the city began to have to grapple with a growing gap between the revenue that it was bringing in, which was steadily declining, and the carrying costs of infrastructure, education, social services, and so forth that went on. So Detroit's bankruptcy is not simply a product of what happened in 2005. It goes back to the post-Second World War II period when plants like Packard were closing their doors and leaving jobs behind, and when River Rouge shed its workforce, eventually going from 90,000 to a little more than 2,000. So while this is happening, another set of major transformations are taking place in Detroit. The auto industry was well paid, and so Detroit became a city of large-scale home ownership. Detroit is a 20th century U.S. city. It doesn't look like Philadelphia or Boston or Baltimore, cities that rose up in the first wave of industrialization. It looks more like Los Angeles or Seattle in its architecture and design. These are 20th century single-family detached houses within the city of Detroit. The vast majority of houses in Detroit are single-family detached homes. They were the kinds of homes that could be built for and inhabited by auto workers making decent pay. But the story of, and these are 1920s-era homes, very typical of large parts of Detroit. They happen to be intact, but I can guarantee you if you walk more than the block in either direction, you'll see empty houses today, even in this sort of comfortably middle-class section of the city with these mock Tudor-style homes built during the city's prosperity. One of the fundamental features of Detroit's housing market was it was deeply divided by race. The city had a small African-American population, about 16% in 1950, and its African-American population was rigidly confined to certain sections of the city by public policy and by private action. The federal government, through housing policies, encouraged home ownership beginning in the Great Depression, but did so by marking neighborhoods that had significant numbers of African-Americans as ineligible for federally backed loans. In effect, ineligible for the types of mortgages that made wide-scale homeownership possible in the United States. Sometimes developers would have to engage in some interesting tactics to ensure banks with federal backing that they were actuarially sound. They didn't have African Americans. The neighborhood on this side of the wall that we're looking at here was an African American neighborhood. This wall was built in 1940 or 1941. There are different accounts as to when it was finished. It runs for half a mile, it's 6 feet high, it's a foot thick, and it divides this neighborhood from the neighborhood where you see those trees, which was going to be built for white occupancy alone. Without constructing the wall, the developer would not be able to persuade the banks that this was a racially homogeneous, all-white neighborhood. This is a picture of some kids, a great picture, I love this. This was taken by a federal photographer during the early 1940s when we had big government programs that subsidized photography through the New Deal and the Great Depression. These are just four black kids on their side of the wall, and it's all full of all sorts of great details, including the little girl holding the white doll. But this is a slightly compressed map that comes from my first book that shows the long-term confinement of the city's African-American population in certain neighborhoods. So this is 1940, and you can see the vast majority of the city's African-American population is concentrated here, with a little bit on the west side and a little bit up here where the wall was. By 1950, that population has expanded outward some. By 1960, this is 1940, 1950, even further, 1960, even further, 1970, even further. But essentially, if you look at the dot density maps, you'll see that the population is not moving in the city in a random pattern. It's moving confined by intense, persistent residential segregation by race. And that residential segregation had all sorts of significant consequences for the city itself and its development and geography, as well as for the population living there. Essentially, it depressed the value of properties in these neighborhoods, which were not eligible for guaranteed mortgages and federally backed home loans. Residents of those neighborhoods were forced to rely on the informal market for mortgages. They had to rely on essentially what were the 1940s and 50s versions of subprime, high interest, high risk loans if they wanted to purchase houses. Property values, because of segregation, also deteriorated because of the assumption that the presence of even a handful of African Americans would devalue properties. This has long-term consequences for the city's fisc as well, because property taxes are central to the city's economy, and property taxes, as the city's black population grows, the property tax base shrinks. Just to give you a sense of segregation, this is a recent dot density map that shows the metropolitan area. And there are a number of patterns here. I could break apart this map for you for a while, but you can see essentially the boundaries of the city of Detroit. Blue means African American. This red color are people who are white. And then this, we'll talk more about this, this yellow area are people who are Latino, and the green area, a tiny little one there, are people of Asian descent. Essentially, Detroit is a black-white city, and the vast majority of the black population in 2010 is still confined within the boundaries of that municipality, that familiar shape that you saw on the previous maps. That's the boundaries of the official boundaries of the municipality. And you can see this line going right across the top here is the northern boundary of the city of Detroit, made famous by the rapper Eminem in his film called 8 Mile. That is 8 Mile Road, which separates the city from its northern suburbs. In recent years, an interesting phenomenon, some African Americans have begun moving into the suburbs. I'm not going to talk about that now, but I can answer questions about it later if you're interested. So, as Detroit is facing the combined effects of the disappearance of its jobs going back to the 1940s and 1950s, and the increased racial segregation of its housing market, and essentially a system of market-guaranteed racial apartheid, the city faces serious fiscal woes that lead to the 2013 bankruptcy. In the aftermath of the bankruptcy, which was settled last year, there have been a number of schemes, some of which have been funded by the city's plan the so-called grand bargain, that is to use money from foundations and the federal government to begin the process of reconstructing the city to make it fiscally self-sustaining once again. What I'm going to argue, and the reason I took you through the quick digression into the city's history, is that unless those who are thinking about the reinvention of Detroit in the aftermath of the bankruptcy grapple not just with the immediate roots of the bankruptcy, but the long-term history of the city, their efforts will be doomed. To make that argument, I'm going to focus for the next few minutes on the strategies going back prior to the bankruptcy, but intensifying after the bankruptcy, that Detroiters have been using to try to rebuild the city. They fall essentially into just a handful of categories. The first and most well-known and prominent is putting your eggs into the downtown redevelopment basket. That is, following a time-honored strategy in cities around the West, including in North America, to invest in downtown with the hopes that the benefits of that investment will trickle down to the remainder of the city's population. This is a sort of fictive construct from the post-bankruptcy plan to redevelop Detroit called Greater Downtown Detroit. The actual downtown is right here, and this is an area called Midtown, which is where the major public library and the Detroit Institute of Arts and Wayne State University, the city's biggest university, are located. Up here is the so-called New Center area, which is a series of mostly decommissioned corporate headquarters. These other areas are mostly former working class neighborhoods surrounding the downtown area. This constitutes 7.2 square miles of a 139 square mile city. And really, if you look at the area that's been the subject of almost all the redevelopment schemes, it's this small area here, which constitutes about 3 square miles of a 139 square mile city. Related to the impetus putting to redeveloping downtown to attract new investment and residents to the downtown area is strategy number 2, which I will call, in an awkward neologism, the hipsterification of Detroit. That is, pursuing a strategy, one that has perhaps been made most famously by the urbanist Richard Florida, to revitalize decaying cities by attracting the creative class to Detroit. So coterminous with efforts to reinvest in Detroit's small downtown have been efforts to attract young artists and other cultural producers to Detroit. Including to this neighborhood right here called Corktown, which was a 19th century Irish working class neighborhood, to Midtown, and to Woodbridge, which is a neighborhood just east of the cultural center. This hipsterification has perhaps attracted the most media attention. In fact, if you go to Detroit now, and I go there several times a year, and I've been going every year for the last most of my adult lifetime, there is more to do in Detroit now for people like me than there ever has been. Better restaurants, better bars, great coffee houses, art galleries galore, and a buzz. Detroit has become, in the words of its most optimistic boosters, the new Brooklyn, the new Williamsburg, or even some more optimistically, the new Berlin. That is a place that is relatively affordable. And indeed, it is. The median housing price in Detroit during the bankruptcy was $26,000 for a house in Detroit. In many of the city's really disinvested neighborhoods, you can pick up a house for anywhere between about $3,000 and $15,000. In other words, it's less to buy a house in Detroit than it is to buy a new model used car. And so Detroit has indeed attracted a lot of artists, people migrating from places like New York where they can no longer afford to live, picking up old warehouses, buying houses with big lots next to them in those abandoned neighborhoods to set up places where you can construct sculpture. And yes, they're robbed, not infrequently, but if you've only paid $8,000, you can have all your welding equipment robbed and by scrappers who are going to use them to raid old buildings and still come out way ahead of of what you would be paying if you lived in Williamsburg or anywhere within the East Coast corridor between Boston and Washington. So hipsterfication is the next major strategy. And Detroit boosters not only point to the fact that the city's got a lot of really great restaurants, bars, and coffee shops now, and art galleries, but for the first time this year, Detroit has seen a net increase in its white population, which led to major headlines in Detroit saying that Detroit is finally coming back. Of course, the number of whites who moved in net between 2010 and 2015 was about 15,000 out of a city of 650,000. Not a huge percentage, and most of the percent increase in the white population has to do with the fact that the black population is continuing to leave the city, an interesting phenomenon. So hipsterfication, strategy number two. Strategy number three, what do we do with that 100 or so square miles of the city that has been left to nature? There's a call in Detroit for reinventing the city as a sustainable city with urban agriculture. And the call for urban agriculture appeals to a remarkable cross-section of people. Hipsters, locavores, investors, homeschoolers who want to live off the grid, and some big land investors, including a wealthy magnate in Detroit who has launched a plan to create a giant Christmas tree farm in the city, arguing that he can create jobs in the process of reclaiming this land for the planting of various pine and spruce and fir trees that can be sold 10 or 20 years from now. Part of the plan for the reinvention of this vast area of empty land in Detroit is a call for making Detroit an environmentally sustainable city. This is quite an interesting set of strategies because Detroit lies over the richest aquifer in the United States. About 40% of the water in the United States emanates from the Great Lakes, and in a period of a crisis over water, there are lots of reasons for coming up with remedial strategies to protect the water supply of an entire region, much of which was covered up by industrial growth and sprawl during Detroit's boom years. All these strategies have difficulties, and what I'm going to do for the next couple minutes, really the last part of my talk, is to do something more, I would say, normative than descriptive or historical, and that is to make some suggestions for how the city might reinvent itself. But before I do that, I just want to give you just a quick slideshow of some of the transformations that have been happening in Detroit. Detroit's biggest downtown investor is the chief executive officer of a company called Quicken Loans. His name is Dan Gilbert. Quicken Loans made a fortune during the lead up to the 2008 crisis through its various and imaginative loan products, many of them predatory. Gilbert got his start in Cleveland, Ohio, nicknamed the Mistake on the Lake, another industrial city that went through hard times, and he's imported his Cleveland model to Detroit, which is investing in commercial and office building in downtown, buying buildings at bargain basement prices. Downtown Detroit is full of abandoned skyscrapers from its glory days. This is one covered with graffiti. There are dozens of them. I could show you many of them. But much of the old office space in Detroit and commercial space is occupied by marginal uses. Here we have a bail bond agency on Detroit's grand shopping avenue, Woodward Avenue. And so Gilbert has been buying up buildings and renovating them, turning former office buildings into condominiums to attract wealthy suburbanites, particularly older people with no children, and young unmarried people back to the center of Detroit. This is a building that was under renovation when I took this photograph last summer. I love the smell of sawdust. And here is a building that's just about finished. It's a really glorious 19-teens era high-rise that's being turned into condominium housing in downtown. This is the Kern Block, the site of a former downtown department store. The only remnant of that store is the clock. Another investor, the head of a software company called CompuWare, decided to move his headquarters to downtown, creating about 4,000 or 5,000 jobs and generating a lot of buzz. But you can see that the area immediately surrounding Detroit's compact downtown is full of abandoned land. But this abandoned land has attracted yet another billionaire investor, a local Detroiter named Mike Ilitch. Ilitch owns one of America's biggest and, frankly, most dreadful pizza chains, a place called Little Caesars. He's become a billionaire from his Little Caesars fortune, and he has purchased the Detroit Red Wings hockey team and has decided to construct a billion point one heavily subsidized redevelopment project called Hockey Town, which is going to occupy this site just north of downtown. Hockey Town centers around the hockey arena, the Detroit Red Wings home, with its great advertising on the roof here, and is a mixed-use development of commercial and retail intended to revitalize this part of the town. Having a building that stands empty for large parts of the year as a center of revitalization is problematic, but there it is. This is a rendering of what Hockey Town is supposed to look like when it's finished, and you can see all of the glories of people riding bikes, which you won't see in a heavily automobile city because you can't really go anywhere, kids and families running across the street, lots of trees, mixed use. It looks quite interesting. We'll see if it actually succeeds. Detroit has also put a lot of energy into attracting the symbols of revitalization and gentrification, including the chain Whole Foods. When it opened, it was front page news in the city as well. And Detroit's got lots of good restaurants. This is one of my meals at a place downtown. Detroit has ruins porn and also food porn. There we are. Art galleries. All part of this strategy. This is one of my favorites. My Parisian urban geographer friend took a picture of this storefront in Corktown, a pawnbroker called Gold Cash Gold, that has now been turned into a trendy high-end restaurant called Gold Cash Gold. It's really good if you go to Detroit and you are a foodie. You'll get a really fine meal there. A kind of cheeky expression of our quest for the authentic, which Detroit has become very much a symbol of in its post-industrial moment. So what I want to do for the next couple of minutes is just very quickly breeze through what I would call a few general principles for thinking about how Detroit can learn from its past and get past its bankruptcy. And I'll call them, for the lack of a better term, lessons. Lesson number one, Detroit needs a diversified labor market with well-paying, secure jobs. By and large, the plans to revitalize the city have created two sorts of jobs. The downtown redevelopment has attracted professionals to the city, which helps the city's tax base, but provides very little opportunity for the vast majority of the city's residents. However, there are certain, the other set of jobs are service sector jobs relating to the city's hospitality industry, washing dishes in restaurants, working as line cooks, et cetera. Detroit does have a different model for the creation of diverse and secure jobs, and this, of course, is one of Detroit's hospitals. In the effort to kind of go for what the travel writers will like, Detroiters in many respects are overlooking some of the city's most important assets. Gentrifying neighborhoods and creating artists, attracting artists and creating new spaces for them is not going to be nearly as important for the long-term future of Detroit as healthcare investment, which is boring, which doesn't make the New York Times and other national magazines and newspapers, but which has been essential to the city's economy and perhaps in the post-Obamacare era, when more people are insured, will continue to be and become even more important to the city's economy. So a diverse economy is important. Next, hipsterification, if we can use that term, the proliferation of trendy dive bars and authentic dining experiences in the city is not going to cut the mustard in a place like Detroit. The gentrified communities only cover a few square miles of 139 square mile city, and much of the development in those neighborhoods is based on what I would call a messianic optimism that somehow young, creative white people coming to a city that's 82.3% African American can remake the city in their image and in the process save it. We need to think about other strategies, not that I have anything against having good restaurants and bars, as you could see from my food porn. Next, Detroit needs to think about the ways in which it right-sizes. That is, it is clear, knowing full well that our crystal balls are murky about the future, that Detroit is never going to be a city of 2 million people again. And having vast sections of a city lying fallow is unsustainable. That is, the city pays a huge amount of money in infrastructure and services for areas that are rural, that are essentially depopulated. One of the primary strategies, and I think a sensible strategy, is to re-densify the city. I'm just going to skip forward to one more map, and then we'll come back to this. To re-densify the city by going for sections that still have a core of population or that have been growing population. The city has called for withdrawing services from neighborhoods that have been depopulated, essentially letting people homestead or do it themselves, rather than continuing to provide costly infrastructure that serves places with a density of 17 people per square mile. The problem with that is that African Americans in Detroit, the city's majority, have a great suspicion about these plans to densify the city and to cut off services, namely that their neighborhoods, their homesteads, the places that they call home, will be destroyed in service of this reinvention of the city. So that requires sensitivity to the city's long history of dislocation and community participation in the process. Next, immigration matters hugely. Every major old industrial city in the United States that's gained population in the last 25 years has done so because of the influx of new immigrants. They're way more important than hipsters, way more important than empty nesters getting downtown condominiums, often heavily subsidized by local tax abatements. They have transformed vast parts of American cities, as well as places like London and many British cities, in profound ways. Detroit is not and has not been for a long time a major immigrant receiving city. But the neighborhoods that have received immigrants are some of the few islands of residential and commercial vitality. Detroit has a neighborhood called Mexican Town. This is a streetscape in Mexican Town. Only about 5% of the city's population is Mexican, but it's a population that has been slowly growing and has reinvigorated this section of the city. Detroit also has a very interesting growing Bangladeshi population. Unlikely, the Bangladeshis have largely moved in a secondary migration from Queens in New York, because Queens is really, really expensive. There are about 7,000 or 8,000 Bangladeshis, mostly on Detroit's east side and some of the most impoverished neighborhoods there, and the business districts and housing stock has been transformed by their moving in, and they've essentially taken over a large segment of the Detroit taxi industry right now, and that population continues to grow. So if you take a look at the areas that are blue, where population has been growing, this area right here is where the Bangladeshis are. This area is Mexico Town, all the way up to the edges of downtown, and these areas that are blue are the areas that are starting to attract empty nesters and hipsters. So when Detroit reimagines itself, it needs to think about the process of immigration. I should say, just as a quick aside, you also see some of Detroit's suburbs. The areas that are blue in the suburbs, and there aren't that many of them, are mostly being populated by blacks moving from the city. The areas in blue over here in Dearborn reflect the fact that Dearborn has the largest Arab American population in the United States, and it has been a major magnet since Ford began recruiting in the Middle East in the 1920s for folks from Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and other parts of the Middle East, and it continues to grow. It's more than half Arab now, and has its first Arab American mayor. So in thinking about the reinvention of the city, finally, we need to raise the question of the relationship of Detroit and its region. This is a critical factor in rethinking the future of American cities. Metropolitan America is deeply balkanized, divided by municipality. There's essentially no difference in this section of Grosse Pointe Park, a suburb that borders Detroit, and Detroit in terms of its street plan, the housing stock, They're about the same size here. We'd be over this part of Grosse Pointe that's now in the picture. You start getting big mansions near a lake. The only difference is this purple line, which is the municipal boundary that separates one from the other. That boundary affects the allocation of goods and services and resources. It leads to, in places like Grosse Pointe, what sociologist Charles Tilly has called resource hoarding. That is, Grosse Pointe has an entirely different tax base than Detroit. It funds some of the best public schools in the United States. It has lots of resources to provide infrastructure and social service to its residents. The difference, at least in this section of Grosse Pointe in Detroit, is that one line that separates city from suburb. Detroit, in other words, and the fate of many American cities depends on doing something that other parts of the world have largely done better than the United States, thinking regionally, thinking about cities as part of a regional system, not just as independent entities left to fend for themselves. If Detroit is left to fend for itself, it may make incremental changes for the better, attracting more interesting people and interesting businesses to the city. But the larger structural problems that I laid out, the flight of industry, the persistence of residential segregation by race, the deep divides that permeate the metropolitan area that are at the root cause of its bankruptcy and the problems that it's faced for a long time won't be solved. I'll stop there. Thank you.
So why don't we take a couple of questions from the floor. There's a microphone. Please wait until you have a microphone in front of you before you start talking, and please introduce yourself when you start talking. Why don't we start over here? Yes.
My name is Cecilia Lindstrom. I'm an urban designer working in London. I just wanted to ask you a question about leadership. I've been talking to people in Detroit, and it seems that one of the issues that come up again and again is the general lack of leadership and of someone actually driving a vision forward for the city and sort of getting everyone behind it to buy into that. And it seems like that's a long-standing issue going way back to the early 1900s, and that a lot of the incentive for future development in Detroit has been essentially driven by the auto industry, which has now essentially left Detroit. So how do you see that moving forward, and is there a solution to that problem? And it's obviously part of the equation.
Yes, that's a very good question. So leadership and the gap of leadership in Detroit is indeed, as you suggest, a problem of long standing. Detroit saw not just the problems with corruption in city government at various critical moments during the Great Depression, during the 1950s, when there was essentially an openly racist mayor in Detroit who used the power of city government to perpetuate and intensify residential segregation, and then the mismanagement in the early 2000s. But Detroit also has a civic elite that is weaker than the civic elite in many other major American cities. Detroit's civic elite, particularly the auto industry elite, never saw themselves as a local elite. They saw themselves as a national or indeed even an international elite. So this summer I was invited to be the kickoff speaker for the first board meeting of the Ford Foundation in Detroit since 1947. The Ford Foundation in 1948 moved to New York, and it moved the stage of its activities to the globe. Recently, the Ford Foundation was instrumental in the so-called grand bargain. They put up about $100 million from their funds to help bail out Detroit and resolve the bankruptcy. And they held their first board meeting in Detroit this past June. But by and large, the city's civic elite has distanced itself from the city and has deprived Detroit of the rich philanthropic base that many American cities, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Cleveland, have had. The Sloan Foundation, which is General Motors Foundation, never had any real interest in Detroit and moved, it was never even located there to the best of my knowledge. And so the consequence is Detroit lacks that. But municipal leadership is overrated in terms of the amount of power that they have given the structure of governance in the United States. That is, mayors and cities are creatures of the state, and they're highly dependent on state governments and on the federal government for funding. Even if Detroit had the most farsighted, visionary leadership in its city hall and its city council, it would not be able to deal with the fact that Detroit, to the rest of Michigan, is the great Satan. That is, it's a primarily African-American and poor city that most of the people in the rest of the state don't care about one bit. So what can a mayor do in that situation? He or she, Detroit has not a female mayor, but he can go to the state capitol and ask for additional money. But with a Republican and suburban and rural dominated legislature, it's very hard to get those resources out of the state. He or she can go to Washington, but in a bipartisan climate of austerity and government cutbacks in spending towards cities since the Carter administration in the 1970s, squeezing money out of Washington is like squeezing water out of a stone. Detroit did see direct benefits from the stimulus package in the early years of the Obama administration, but it was very short-lived. And so thinking about leadership is part of the story, but even the most far-sighted and imaginative leadership in Detroit would have to deal with the larger ways in which governance and the distribution of resources are structured in the United States, and that's a really big problem. Even cities that are much stronger than Detroit, with very talented mayors, have faced really significant obstacles because of the state and federal system of governance.
Yeah, right up here in the front row. Right over here, actually.
Hello, Joe Carr. I'm a big enthusiast for Detroit. I was just wondering, the Mexican town solution or prescription you had at the end, isn't that just replicating the problem that got embedded in Detroit in the first great wave of immigration prior to the 1920s, where the creation of monocultural neighborhoods, where there is no model of integration whatsoever? I mean, looking from London, however imperfect diversity and integration is, we've never had neighborhoods called Corktown or Greek Town or Mexican Town or Black Bottom or any of those other places that Detroit's divided into.
Yeah, that's a very good question. The great urban social historian Olivier Zuntz at the University of Virginia did a really detailed study of ethnicity and housing patterns in Detroit in the critical period that you're describing, when Corktown and many of these other ethnic enclaves emerged, the period from 1880 to 1920. Subsequently, his findings have been replicated for other cities. And that is, most of these self-identified ethnic neighborhoods are actually very heterogeneous. There were very few neighborhoods that had a majority of one ethnic group living in it. The big divide in Detroit wasn't Mexican, Greek, Irish living in separate enclaves. Many of those enclaves were enclaves because of the visibility of institutions, churches, and shops that catered to that ethnic group, but not necessarily the concentration of residents. The real question in Detroit is the division between white and black. And that's a division that really begins in the 1920s. It's an intensified by housing policy, by real estate practices, and by the re-identification of many of these ethnic groups as whites, defining themselves in contradistinction to the city's African-American majority population. So when I look at, and I didn't mention this, but the period of intense segregation in the post-Second World War II years in white neighborhoods was led by what you could call a United Nations of non-blacks. So you would have streets that had German, Irish, Polish, Italian, Anglo-Canadian, all living together in the same block, getting along more or less, but defining themselves as unified against the encroachment of African Americans onto their turf, which goes back to the slide with the boundaries. Go back to that really quickly. If I didn't get there, I should come this way. No, it's going to take me too long to go back there. But suffice it to say, that white-black divide in metropolitan Detroit, as in much of the northeastern and midwestern United States, indeed much of the United States, has been the insuperable one and the one that's been extraordinarily difficult to overcome. So the coming of Mexicans, yes, they're mostly concentrated in the southwest section of the city, but they're living in streets that have whites or African Americans living on them as well. They're bringing investment to the city's commercial strips, places that were essentially left for dead 20 years ago. And so their impact might not necessarily be so much in the ethnic relations or the racial relations of Detroit, but rather in the reinvestment in the city's housing and commercial real estate.
Can I ask a supplementary?
Yeah.
Why don't we actually move on to somebody else? You can probably catch him afterwards.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
Yes, right up here.
Thanks. Hi, my name's Amy Kenyon, and I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit and actually have written a book called Dreaming Suburbia. Which
I know your work. It's great to meet you.
Greatly helped by yours. And I really wanted to ask what you thought the current state of city-suburb relations are, or how hopeful you are.
Yeah.
Given your last point, your last suggestion in particular.
Well, I pulled up the right map, didn't I? So the relation between Detroit City and suburbs has been intensely fraught for a very long period of time. It's the natural outgrowth of the intense racial polarization between blacks and whites in Detroit. Until very recently, this would have been all red, this area with a couple of little enclaves accepted. That's changing, and it's changing in very interesting ways. It leads some optimists to say, the movement of blacks into Southfield or into Warren, into Harper Woods, these communities that were all white suburbs until recently on the periphery of Detroit, heralds a positive change, a transformation. A transformation echoed by America's election of an African American to the White House. That is, we're finally seeing suburban integration. However, when you look at the patterns of black residents in the suburbs closely, you find that the vast majority of African Americans who are leaving the city, they're moving to suburbs that are close to Detroit, or as in over here and over here, close to long-standing black enclaves. Their movement is not random. Their movement is still structured by a real estate market that steers African Americans into certain neighborhoods and whites into certain neighborhoods. The suburbs that African Americans are moving into are what I've called, and I wrote a piece in the New York Times about this, secondhand suburbs. They're places that become increasingly unfashionable among whites. Older housing stock, not very big, not so appealing. And the process of white flight in Detroit in the post-Second World War II period was really fast. Within 5 years, a block would go from being all black, all white to all black. Suburbs, the process is a lot slower. But if you look closely, you see some very distinctive patterns. The whites who stay are older whites without children. No new whites, younger whites, whites with children, whites with families, are moving into these communities. So the process of racial change is happening, just not at the same pace. So in other words, older whites without children have more tolerance about having some black neighbors than they would have 50 years ago. That's a sign of progress. But younger whites do not want to raise their children in communities with any number of African Americans or schools with any number of African Americans. And so if you look at the demographics of the age in these suburbs, you'll find that the blacks are a lot younger than the whites. And over time, those neighborhoods begin to turn over really quickly. So this area, Southfield, is a pretty wealthy middle-class black suburb. And one high school in a 20-year period went from being mostly white to 90% African-American, and the other high school is now going through that process. Southfield is essentially going to be an all-black suburb very soon. And I expect that will happen with some of these other suburbs as well as fewer whites move in. So that poisons city-suburban relations, but also means that some of these near suburbs could be allies with Detroit in pushing for additional funds and support from the state government and elsewhere. And so that might, on the margins, reconfigure some of the power relationships between the city and the rest of the region.
Hi there. My name is Jared, a student at SOAS. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on Gar Alperovitz's kind of idea of democracy collaborative, when it kind of goes into areas such as Detroit or kind of looks at the idea of the Cleveland model, which looks at the idea of kind of municipal-run enterprises or kind of cooperative enterprises within the community to kind of keep the capital kind of based within kind of a local area. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that and if you think that's kind of an efficient method of a solution. Thanks.
I can't speak to Alperovitz's argument. I haven't read it in a really long time. And so I would be loath to give you some specifics on this, except for to say that from your description, it sounds like a species of an argument that's been made really since the 1960s about the need for community-generated economic development and for a local capitalism that keeps investment and money quote, within the community rather than having it exported outward. I'm pretty skeptical of that framework for all sorts of reasons, in part because the scale of those kinds of cooperatives and local businesses is very small. They don't generate very many jobs. Most small businesses generate only a handful of jobs. The model in some ways doesn't address the larger regional, national, and even international economy that Detroit is in some ways the end of the road consequence of. I mean, really dramatic changes. Americans are really, really, really good about thinking locally and about believing that somehow local solutions are going to solve problems. Local activists, local organizations, local governments have the will, abundant will, sometimes backed with some modest foundation support, but seldom the capacity to deal with the macroeconomic problems and the macro-political problems that are afflicting Detroit. So is having locally controlled businesses in Detroit a net plus? Yes. Is community economic development generated from the bottom up for the city? Yes. But is it ever going to aggregate to a scale necessary to deal with the larger macro political, fiscal, economic problems and racial problems that I've described? I don't see evidence of that in the current system in the United States. So again, being agnostic about Alperovitz's specific arguments.
More questions? We can take one or two more. Yeah, over here. Actually, you had your hand up before, right? We wanted to go up here and then back here.
Hi. So I'm Layla, studying at UCL in the geography department. So Detroit, much like Cleveland, is also a victim of mall porn, I guess you could call it, right? Abandoned malls on BuzzFeed and these, like, decaying shopping centers. So I guess I'm wondering what the future is for shopping and for, you know, consumerism, really, in that basic sense of where do people go, and, you know, are mall providers or whoever is building malls afraid to build them again? And also, what's the relationship between, you know, malls in the suburbs and, you know, essentially rebuilding a city, you know, yeah, with regards to shops?
A really good question. Detroit proper, Detroit proper has no shopping malls as such, right? There are some little strip malls with four or five little stores, mostly small local businesses that have replaced sort of Main Street shopping, but nothing resembling a mall in Detroit, really. The malls are in a ring of suburbs, and the first ring, Northland, one of the really prototypical malls in the United States, Amy knows about this, of course, just closed. Is in the process of closing. Westland, which is over in one of these working class western suburbs, is on the brink. The Livonia Mall, which is in a western suburb about here, is mostly gone. It's disappearing. But new forms of malls are emerging further out. They tend to be on a new urbanist model where you've got outdoor areas, big pedestrian walkways, they're not enclosed. They allow for a little more movement of traffic and people through. They were prototyped in places like Southern California. They don't work so well in cold climates, but they do work. People find them a little more urban, a little more lively and interesting, a little bit more like the downtowns that they romanticize than the big covered malls or the modernist malls like Northland and Westland. So what's the future? I mean, again, I'm a historian, and what I will say is history is littered with bad predictions. Right, the vast majority of people who try to make predictions about the future. The Brookings Institution in 1971 did a study of American cities, and it listed the most distressed cities in the United States, and the top two, I forget which one was one and which one was two, were Detroit, they were right, and Boston, wrong, big time wrong, right? And they made the prediction that they would only get worse over time. And any sensible person in 1970 would say, yeah, Boston's doomed, right? So what happens to shopping malls? I'm going to be very parsimonious with my predictions. What I will say is that holiday in-store sales in the United States, even though the economy is good, went down, and a lot more people are shopping online. And so what does that mean for shopping malls? Probably doesn't bode well. But I'm making that parsimoniously because I can't predict with accuracy.
Back here.
We'll take one question after this. Hi, I'm Matt. I'm a student of architecture at UCL. I wanted to ask you about schooling. I spent quite a lot of time in Detroit last year, and I lived in Mexicantown, weirdly. And that was kind of a funny area because there were loads of kids around. It was one of the few areas where there was actually kind of a diverse community and kind of all ages. And obviously it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. You're not going to have schools when you don't have young children. But I guess, yeah, kind of a strange question. How do you see that moving forward?
I have a whole section of this talk that deals with education that I took out, but we can talk about it quickly. Public education is a resource distributed geographically in the United States. Metropolitan Detroit has 89 separate school districts encompassing the area on this map and more. Each of those school districts relies heavily on local property tax bases for its finances, which means that Detroit, because its property tax base is very low, has struggled to fund its schools for a very long time. You can go 10 miles away to Birmingham, not at all like your Birmingham, one of the wealthiest suburbs, and find de facto private schools, schools that serve a wealthy community funded by a very lucrative local tax base. You go to Bloomfield Hills or Troy or the Grosse Pointe and find really superb, well-funded schools with the most recent facilities. Detroit has fallen prey to the fads of education reform in the United States, in part because during the fiscal crisis of the last 10 years, the city was put into emergency management, a process I didn't talk about. Essentially, the finances of the city were given over to an agent of the governor to restructure the city, to lay people off, to reorganize city agencies, to cut spending. And the public school district has gone through a series of emergency managers. That coincided with a great deal of interest in the United States in charter schools, in privately run public schools, in experiments that essentially assumed that if you change the way a school is organized internally, including administratively or fiscally, you could transform education by making schools competitive, right? It's a market-based framework for thinking about public education within a district. Well, you might make schools competitive within the city of Detroit, but you're dealing with schools that face a structural deficit because of their reliance on local property taxes. It means that under the best of circumstances, these schools are still facing really significant fiscal constraints. But more than that, because of the ways in which the population is racially and socioeconomically maldistributed across the metropolitan area, you have children with the most educational and familial and economic disadvantages concentrated in a handful of districts. So these are kids that in many respects require more resources, smaller classes, etc., but they're not getting it. And so essentially what we do in the United States, to put it really crassly and bluntly, is we concentrate the poorest kids in the poorest districts, and then we blame the districts and the teachers for not producing educational outcomes that are comparable to those in the wealthiest districts. An American would respond to me by saying, most Americans would respond to me across the political spectrum by saying, well, it's not just money. There are other problems at work. But I will throw out a crude counterfactual. Imagine taking a resident of Bloomfield Hills that spends about $23,000, $24,000 per capita, per kid in that school district, and say, take the $11,000 or $12,000 per kid that Detroit pays, give that to your children, and give your $28,000 or $24,000 to children in the city of Detroit. Would parents in Bloomfield Hills support that? Not a chance, because they wouldn't have their own computers. They wouldn't have classroom sizes of 18. They wouldn't have teachers who are among the best funded, best paid in the United States. They wouldn't have beautiful campuses that look like some of the richest universities in the world. Of course they wouldn't give those up. There are many other issues that face the Detroit public schools, including declining. Most of the schools in the city were built in the 1920s or the 1960s. The ones from the 20s are really old and decrepit. The ones in the 1960s have reached the end of their useful life in terms of their roofs, their heating, their infrastructure, and so forth, and they're crumbling away. And as you noticed when you were in Mexicantown, the African Americans who are moving to the city suburbs are disproportionately those with kids because they want to get out of the Detroit public school system because the outcomes are so bad, which has led to the mass closure of schools in the city. Which in some ways has created other problems, including the fact that you have to travel longer distances to get to school within this pretty vast city itself. So the problem is the region. And despite the American penchant for one-shot silver bullet solutions, as with the charter school matters, most of these gimmicks have mixed results at best.
So I'm afraid we're out of time. I apologize to you for that. But I want to thank you all for coming to this early in the term lecture. And most importantly, let's all thank Tom for joining us here at the LNC.
And thank you for your excellent questions. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to answer more.